A reading from the Gospel of Matthew. Whoever welcomes you welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. Whoever welcomes a prophet in the name of a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. And whoever welcomes a righteous person in the name of a righteous person will receive the reward of the righteous. And whoever gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones in the name of a disciple, truly I tell you, none of these will lose their reward. This is the gospel of grace. Thanks be to God.
100 years ago, in the pulpit of the city of New York's First Presbyterian Church, Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick preached a famous sermon titled, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" It was a bolt of thunder struck across the ecumenical skyline, giving light and energy to those championing a more open and inclusive way of living out Christian faith in the modern world. How are we to live out our old faith in this new age? What are we to think of science and progress? What about history and evolution? What faith do we put in the priest in the age of the surgeon? And who gets to say what the ultimate truth is that we must be taught and believe? Is this truth truly locked in the pages of a closed book or the pews of an old-time religion? Or can our minds be open to new facts and new revelations? Does the earth now revolve around the sun, or does it still revolve around the Bible? Can old dogmas and old doctrines be questioned? Can new ideas be conceived? Can new light be followed? Can new questions be asked? Can old answers be rejected? Or shall the fundamentalists win? To these questions this morning, I add one other serious consideration facing us now in this modern world. How in this thoroughly globalized, increasingly secularized, often polarized, and very, very diverse world, are we as Christians to relate to those of other religions or no religion at all? Particularly in these united but also very divided states of America. What place does our faith have in the public square or the public schools? Is it a place of privilege? Is it a place of domination? Do we uphold the doctrine of the separation of church and state and the freedom of and from religion? Or is it our God-given right to subdue this country and this earth under the aegis of a Christian flag and a Christian government. Shall government make no law respecting the establishment of religion? As the Constitution says, and as a little boy I was first taught. Or, to play on Fostick's old question, shall the Christian nationalists win? By Christian nationalism, I mean the ideology that holds that it is a so-called Christian right to elect so-called Christian leaders in order to enact a so-called Christian law in a so-called Christian nation. And I say so-called for two reasons. One, because not everybody's idea of Christianity or Christian laws is the same. And two, because according to the Christianity of some of us, the very idea of a Christian nation is in and of itself an unchristian notion. When the framers of the Constitution drafted the First Amendment right to the freedom of and from religion, they did so with the understanding that there were many and diverse sects of Christianity all across America. There were Pennsylvania Quakers, Maryland Catholics, New England Congregationalists, New York Presbyterians, Georgia Methodists, Virginia Baptists, South Carolina Episcopalians, and even a few, I presume, who were actually following Jesus. It was a compromise for the sake of the country to say Congress could not establish one over any of the others when the Constitution was first drafted in 1787. And I would say what was good for the country on that account in 1787 ought still to be good today. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and neither do I believe should our state, our county, or our local governments either. So when people say they want prayer back in schools, and the Bible taught in the classroom, I have to ask, who's praying? And who is going to be the teacher of those scriptures? Because I know that I don't want the Pope in Rome or the presbytery in Scotland deciding what prayers get sanctioned before the Pledge of Allegiance in America. And neither do I want some of the old coaches I had in high school teaching my children the meaning of the Ten Commandments. Those old coaches were good at X and O's, but I will have to pass on their playbook of the Apocalypse of John. Think about it. So it troubles me. It really, really troubles me that in Texas, just in this past session, Our illustrious legislator has voted to allow religious chaplains to replace licensed counselors in our public schools. As if we didn't have enough to worry about when we send our children off to school in the morning. And I am sorry to say that it was a Baptist who first submitted this chaplain bill. And it is Baptists all over Texas and elsewhere who have given up the core tenet of separation of church and state and have bought in hook, line, and sinker into this idea of Christian nationalism. The old school Baptists believed in the separation of church and state. The Baptist preacher Isaac Backus was one of its strongest proponents in the early colonies. Before that, Roger Williams, the founder of the first Baptist church in America, wrote of the hedge or wall protecting church from state and established the first state founded on the idea of religious liberty. And later it was George W. Truett, pastor of First Baptist Dallas and president of the Southern Baptist Convention, who stood on the steps of the U.S. Capitol and gave his famous Baptist and religious liberty speech, in which he called the melding of church and state the most baneful misalliance that ever fettered and cursed a suffering world. Dr. Truett didn't mince words. Shudder to think then what he would say of his church and his denomination now, draped in the flag as they are. Believe me, not everybody's idea of Christianity is the same. I want the hedge to protect us from some of the Baptists every bit as much as I want it to protect us from the Pope or the Muslims or the Hindus or the Jews. And vice versa, them from us, because we are all Americans, and we all pay taxes, unless we're rich. That's another sermon. And we all have, the same fundamental First Amendment rights of equal protection under the law and the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Congress shall not, nor should any other governmental entity in America either. So I think we need to seriously consider why it is that so many Baptists and other so-called Christians have been so eager to embrace this whole idea of so-called Christian nationalism. The abuses of history make me more a cynic than a true believer in the merits of so-called Christian nations and Christian leaders. What was particularly Christian about Constantine or Rome or Henry VIII, the supreme head of the Church of England, or 17th century Salem, or the Confederate States of America? Did they worship? And did they follow in the way of the one who said, love your God and love your neighbor as yourself? Or was the country Christianized more for the purposes of command and control, occupation, and domination? Was the cross a symbol of sacrifice and selfless service, or, as in the case of Constantine and the Confederacy, was it weaponized as a standard for conquest and war, manifest destiny and native misery? Roger Williams, who was an advocate for native peoples and a great, great critic of the abuses of the established church, both in Europe and also in America, once said, "Christenings make not Christians." I think that can be said both about babies and also about nations. I want to end today on a sober note by warning you, by telling you we have got to be vigilant right now. The Christian nationalism that is sweeping through our country is more than just a small threat. It is truly a potential scourge. It was Christian nationalism that marched into our nation's capital, carrying the Christian flag on January 6th. And it's Christian nationalism that Amanda Tyler of the Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty says is the single biggest threat to America's religious freedom. And now one sitting U.S. Congresswoman says her party needs to be the party of Christian nationalists, while another says she's tired of this separation of church and state junk, and that the church is supposed to direct the government. To that statement comes to my mind the old adage, Lord, save us from your followers. This is not Christianity, beloved. It is blasphemy. And it is also tyranny. It is blasphemy because it takes the cross of Christ, a symbol of sacrifice and love, and turns it into a weapon of coercion and control. And it is tyranny because it takes a democracy, government of the people and by the people and for the people, and turns it into a theocracy governed of and by and for the high priests of a very fundamentalist sect of a so-called Christianity of which I have no desire to either be a member or a subject. I want you to know. I want you to know that I think we ought to fight the good fight against this everywhere we find it. In the halls of Congress, and on the steps of the Capitol, and on the dais of school boards and city councils, and in the office of the counselor now turned chaplain. We should fight it everywhere we find it, because it would be an absolute civil and possibly human rights tragedy if the Christian nationalists were to win. I like what Charles Kuyker told me this morning. I think theocracy is a great idea, but who gets to be Theo? Christenings make not Christians. And so-called Christian leaders making so-called Christian laws make not a Christian nation either. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, Mother of us all, together all of God's people do say,